Well, we should rename the podcast NHL at Fanfare, Sean, because we are at the All-Star Game Fanfare, which is pretty cool. It's hopping right now. You got alumni everywhere. We got an alumni sitting right with us. But Sean, this is our first on-location podcast, and I got to say, I think we should do more of these.
We should. We should make it a boondoggle where we go to every event and do this. And it's awesome. This is one of my favorite parts about All-Star. As you come here, it's a celebration of the game. Trophies are right next to us. Guys, alumni telling stories over there, street hockey, all kinds of fun and games. You could spend, as a hockey fan, you could spend hours. Can't forget the Black History Truck.
Yep.
The history of black players in our league. I could spend hours here, but we got a show to do. And we have an important guest to start it off in Andrew Ferentz, one of our co-workers, former Boston Bruins, Stanley Cup champion. I would tell you his title at the NHL, but we don't need to get into that. Andrew,
please.
It's great having you here.
Nice to be here. Yeah, that wouldn't be good radio, so this is cut to the chase.
I will also say it, NHL Director of Social Impact, Growth, and Fan Development. So it's a long, wordy title.
It is.
But it's an impactful title. I mean, you have an impact right now, and one of the things, the reason you're here, and you know, I think it's actually one of the coolest things and most important things at Fanfare right now is the NHL Street Program. So I'm going to give you the floor to kind of explain what this all is, because this, to me, the ball hockey, you know, a program sponsored by the NHL, you're getting more kids into the game.
Yeah, I mean, like, we'll start with the basics. Like, we're not recreating the wheel here. Like, street hockey's been around probably forever. But, you know, a couple years ago, I obviously came on to the league, and the main mandate was get more people into hockey, you know. So, I don't know, you could take that a number of different directions. And, you know, talking with colleagues, mainly my real good buddy at the NHL, Paul Akaruba, who I actually worked with as a player to develop NHL Green. So I had a pre-existing relationship with him, and we would get in. You know, you always have that buddy you sit around and have a drink with and solve all the world's problems. And, you know, for us, we sat around for a bit and tried to say, like, how do we wrap our arms around the most people and introduce them to the game of hockey? You know, you could think of different things on the ice and different ways of playing the game and engaging them. But at the end of the day, when we started breaking down, you know, what the barriers are to our game, you know, whether it's access to an ice rink or family history with the game or it not being culturally relevant to people, you go on and on, you know, price point, you land at street hockey because it is the easiest way to play our game. You need a stick, a ball, you know, something to shoot on, and then a bunch of buddies. But the game of street hockey is always just, you know, it's been a kind of an afterthought from a league level. And man, we have some teams that have done a really good job that have engaged kids at schools and set up some leagues. But that has its own limitations as well because, you know, teams only have so many people, you know, on staff to run these things. So we essentially went down the path of finding a good partner to work with to eventually have more kids playing street hockey than ice hockey. And hopefully the next, like, I don't know, 5 years. So that partner is RCX Sports. A lot of people are familiar with the NFL flag program. So flag football, more kids play flag football than tackle football now. They have over 500,000 kids playing. So this group, you know, works with Boys and Girls Clubs, YMCAs, Parks and Recs Department, and that's essentially what we're going to do. We're going to recreate, you know, that kind of model but with hockey and get into the Albuquerque, New Mexico's, the North Dakota's, Saskatchewan, where no NHL teams are, where we don't have a presence, and also obviously into our markets as well. But we've created a fun, really, really fun street hockey program. It looks cool. You know, you guys took a visit over there and saw, you know, what it looks and feels like. We've got some great design to it. We're going to have cool jerseys, have music playing all the time, and not a bunch of coaches and tactics and yelling parents and seriousness. I mean, you know, we want to create just good memories. We don't need to create a whole batch of, like, the next NHLers. You know, that might happen organically on its own where kids will migrate to ice hockey and stuff, but we just want to create really fun times and, you know, good memories with hockey.
I didn't see any neutral zone trap being played over there when I was watching.
Yeah.
But I mean, we all forget because we're in hockey and we've been in it for so long. Like, that is everybody's basis. I remember being a young kid playing in front of my house, chasing that orange ball all the way down the street, and you missed the net, so you got really good at shooting quickly because you didn't want to run down the street. But you mentioned they've done it in places like in Dallas, during the All-Star game. They did it in Tampa Bay. They built the outdoor rinks as the legacy project. The same thing in San Jose. And you watch these kids who have never played before, and within 5 minutes, huge smiles on their faces. And they're hooked, like, immediately, because we know the power of the game, but you need to introduce people to it.
Look, it's fun. Like, it's so much fun. A lot of the kids that are here this weekend have never played hockey. My buddy Paul was telling me that in this whole state of Nevada, I think there's 2,000 registered ice hockey players in the whole state. In Vegas, you know, it's in, you know, I think just around 1,000. So we're going to engage about the same number over this weekend just in ball hockey alone. A lot of these kids have never, you know, picked up a stick. They've never skated. This form of the game is so accessible, and it's a blast. I mean, if you're in junior high, I know what I was like. I probably, if I had never skated before, wouldn't have, like, found my way to an ice rink and learned how to skate. That takes multiple, you know, it's an ongoing thing. It takes a lot of times to learn how to skate, let alone, all right, now I got to pick up a stick. Yeah. Now I got to join a league. And, you know, we know hockey. There's not a lot of chill hockey leagues where you can kind of just go and, like, play. You know, you get to a certain age and it's travel teams, it's serious, there's a lot of coaching, there's, you know, it's a different level of, you know, what a lot of kids just don't want. We didn't just kind of like I said, we shared a drink and tried to solve the world's problems, but we also looked into a lot of the data that USA Hockey collects, Hockey Canada. You talk to a lot of families, you know, you learn what's keeping them away from the game. It's not always just price. Sometimes it's commitment. I don't want to, you know, parents will tell you, I don't want to be driving across the city and across the state to play hockey three times a week on different days of the week. It takes away everything else I can do in life. A lot of kids say, like, I stop because I don't need a coach yelling at me. You know, I don't want to have all this structure. I just want to go play. And so when you start listening to what some of these needs are, you know, this is what we're trying to create. I actually liken it to, we're trying to almost make like a real life video game. You know, you picture when a kid goes to a, you know, gets a new video game, comes out, you know, let's say it's NHL 22. They don't go to the store, buy it, come back home, read the entire instruction booklet, and then get coached, you know, for six sessions before they're allowed to play the game, right? They just grab the controller and figure it out and play it and be creative, and they're kind of just unlimited creativity to it. And those are the best video games, right? Like, it's fun. And so when you kind of try to translate that into real life, like, what does it turn into? And, I mean, hopefully that's what we're trying to make street look like. You show up, you grab a stick, music's playing, you figure it out.
Yeah. It's interesting because in my town, there's a street hockey program, and it's very successful. I live in New Jersey. My nephew's been playing street hockey 8 years. He's a senior in high school now. They have a high school division, you know, 5th through 8th grade, and then 9th through 12th grade, and then even younger than that, too. They have more, like, clinics for them, and they play games, too. He's never stepped foot on the ice, ever. I don't think he's ever put on skates, except maybe to skate with his girlfriend one time, right? But it is the same thing. He has a stick, he has a helmet, he's got gloves, shin pads, whatever, and they give him a jersey, and he goes out and plays and has a blast every weekend he does it, right? And I keep thinking to myself, like, you know, this is probably part of the conversation. You hear about basketball. All you need is a ball and a hoop, right?
Yeah,
this
exactly.
is the same now. This is the hockey version.
Yeah, and the fact that, you know, at the end of the day, this is a business, right? Like, the NHL is trying to generate revenue and create fans and create. But what is that? Like, what is that? I mean, I equate fandom to having, like, really good emotional attachments to the game. So whether that's, you know, a friend or family member taking you to watch an NHL game and you have a great time, you know, you're associating a good positive memory with hockey. For us, like, that's what we're trying to do, is have a whole generation of kids have really positive associations with our sport. They showed up, they you know, were playing, let's say, flag football in the middle of Texas, and then that same Boys and Girls Club had NHL Street, you know, for 8 weeks after, you know, NFL flag football. They try it. They had a blast. It was a great time. Forever they'll have, you know, for the rest of their life, they'll have those positive memories of hockey and that positive association. And our chances of developing that person into somebody who cares about hockey and then teaches their kids about hockey and has a good time, like, you don't ever have to see ice or ever have to touch ice or skate or anything. We don't need, like, a pathway for everybody. Like I said, like, look, I played pro. Like, I get it. Like, I'm super competitive, and I love that, and I love being coached, and I love tactics and X's and O's. But I know that I'm in the minority. Like, a lot of people don't want that. Like, that's not fun to a lot of people. And so, you know, we're just trying to make sure that we have that covered, and we're putting enough resources and time and commitment and, like, our brand and attention into what's probably a much, much, much bigger population that just wants that really good time. And instead of trying to develop NHLers, we're just trying to develop memories.
And the kids who do take it serious, like, you look at California, they all started with roller hockey.
Yeah.
And the creativity there is unbelievable, right? So,
and that path exists, yeah, right? Like, those kids that want to take that next step and learn how to play and go into the travel teams and get, like, you know, get the extra, like, hockey schools and skill sessions and all that. Like, it's funny, like, that elite model and elite pathway is really well developed.
Yeah.
You know, because there's a good business model behind it as well, yeah, right? But that grassroots, like, pathway is heavily underdeveloped. You know, like, you think of, like, really high-quality house leagues. It's hard to find. Like, even in Edmonton, like, where I live, like, it's hard to find, like, a really high-quality house league program where you can just kind of go chill and play once a week.
And you mentioned it being the league being a business, which it is, obviously. I'm looking over there, and you got kids wearing Rangers jerseys, Vegas Golden Knights jerseys, right, Bruins jerseys. And you know as well as I do, you throw a Rangers jersey and a kid lets start, oh, man, he's all of a sudden going to be a Rangers fan if he doesn't have an NHL team. Hey, Mom, Dad, can you go get me an Artemi Panarin T-shirt, right? Oh, there's the business aspect of it, I would imagine.
No, we want our brands. Like, look, we want our brands everywhere. And actually, you know, I played for a number of teams. I played for the Blackhawks when I was growing up. I played for I think the Blues 1 year, you know, so you rotate NHL teams, but I lived in Edmonton, but I was exposed to multiple NHL brands, you know, because of your youth hockey experience. So similar to that, yeah, you're bang on. Like, we don't want just, you know, in one market to have one team represented. Back to the video game analogy, right? Like, if I'm in Las Vegas and I'm a, you know, Golden Knights and a hockey curious kid, and I go pick up the EA Sports Hockey and bring it home, like, when I pop it in, I'm not allowed to just only be the Vegas Golden Knights. Like, yeah, I can pick any team, right? And I can be, you know, the Ducks, and I can be the Oilers, and be Connor McDavid, and all these things. And, you know, I think that's the other aspect of it is, right, making sure that we see the bigger picture of selling hockey and growing the game and growing that exposure to multiple teams and multiple players, no matter where you live, right? You know, the NFL's done a good job of that. You look at, you know, casual fans, like, there's Cowboy fans in every city. There's, like, you know, Pittsburgh fans in every city. Like, certain brands have done a better job of that. But I think from a league's point of view, we can help that along, right? Like, we can help expose multiple markets to multiple brands.
Yeah.
Well, I have to ask you, you played in the league, like you mentioned. We're at All-Star. Do you see, as a former player, the creativity level that our players have today? Do you think it's at an all-time high?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, the skill level is out of this world. I mean, it progresses so fast, the speed of the game, the creativity of it. And that's a combination, I think, of a couple things. I think that obviously the development of kids at a younger age, like I said, that elite pathway is really, really well developed. So they have incredible coaching from a young age to develop those skills. But the other side of it is our coaches have changed, right? Like, that culture of making a mistake and, you know, being allowed to try things and be creative. Like, you don't have to go back too far. Like, when I was coming through, like, as a young player, you make a couple mistakes and you're on the bench for the rest of the, you know, or you're down in the minors. Or the price that you paid for trying something and it not working the first time was very high. And I think that it's healthy that it's changed because it, you know, you're not going to be perfect. Like, you're not going to try really super creative things and try things that are take an incredible amount of skill. They're not going to work every time. You're playing against other NHL players who are very good at defense. You know, but the fact that our coaches have you know, I think understood that, you know, developing that creativity and giving guys a little bit more freedom to try that, in the long run ends up developing really, really good players. Like, how many players, you know, were awesome in junior and, you know, you could go out there and see him play scrimmage and you see him play summer hockey and you're like, wow, like, this guy is so talented. He could do so much. But then put him into a restrictive system where the coach benches him the first turnover because he tried something that, you know, didn't work perfect the first time. Like, and the confidence is shot, you know, the creativity is shot, and right away, like the price, like I said, the price is too high for a mistake.
But is there a trust to that, though? Do you think part of that, you know, the coach is showing a little more leniency and allowing, you know, playmakers to make plays? Does it come with a trust level from a coaching perspective? Do you think they have to develop a trust in the player before they take the training wheels off or take the restrictions out? Or do they just, has coaching evolved now from what you've seen in the game and what you know in the game to, no, this guy's just going to go. We're going to deal with it. Any mistake, we'll deal with it, but we got to let him go.
Well, I mean, I guess a coach probably could answer better than I could.
but you see it. You played.
But, I think there is a balance. Like, it's not like everybody on the roster has the ability to do some of the incredible things. Like, that is still the cream of the crop, right? Mm-hmm. So I would be lying if I said the third line guys got just as much freedom as the first line guys to be creative and, you know, show us what you got, kid. Like, that's not really the way it works. But I think the best coaches that I've heard, you know, kind of say, like, look, like, on the defensive side of the puck, when we're defending, like, this is non-negotiable. Like, you are the hardest back checker. You are responsible for your man. You are coming back and covering high. Like, all the things that you have to do, right? Non-negotiables. But, you know, offensively, once we get across the red line, like, have at her. Like, I've seen that approach from coaches, and I think that's probably where, you know, kind of, you know, balances out.
That's the balance, yeah.
Yeah, because, look, like, you know, mistakes are going to happen. And I guess, like, yeah, if you make 50 mistakes and it only works once, like, all right, figure it out. Like, you got to have a better ratio than that, right? But, look, you get into playoffs, things are going to tighten up. You know, certain times of the year, things are going to tighten up and you're going to play a lot more responsibly. And if you want to be in the NHL a really long time, you're going to figure that out pretty quick, too, because, I mean, you're not going to have a job for a long time if your ratio is 50-1 mistake to success.
Before I let you go, I'm going to ask you then and now a question that's kind of along those lines. When you played, who was the one guy that you lined up across from and you were like, he was the guy that was going to keep you up at night trying to figure out how to defend? And who's the guy now when you're sitting on your couch having a drink saying, oh, am I glad I'm retired and I don't have to deal with that cat?
Well, I was lucky enough to actually start with Alexei Kovalev. I started on Pittsburgh and think of the crazy roster I played on. I had Alexei Kovalev, Mario Lemieux, Jaromir Jagr, Marty Straka, like Robert Lang, like a crazy, crazy talented team, right? But Kovalev was just like insane. Like the things he could do with the puck. And the neat thing about him was he was actually a really good coach. Like being a young defenseman, like he would stick around after practice and be like, come here. Like I'm going to show you how to like defend a guy like me. And he was probably the best coach I ever had, like, because he taught me so much. But then trying to play against him, like, once I got traded and stuff, like, oh my God, he was a nightmare. He was so good. He'd make you look silly. Now I just feel sorry for guys when they have to go against, like, McDavid, McKinnon, you see some really, really good defensemen that just look fairly amateur when you got a full speed Connor McDavid coming down on him. But I mean, what can he do? He's so fast and deceptive, right? But I guess they're in good company when, you know, it's not, he's not just picking on one of them. He's making everybody look silly.
Yeah, no doubt. Andrew, thanks so much for stopping by.
Yeah.
This is great. And good luck with the program, man. All right.
Yeah, pleasure. Thanks for giving it some exposure.
Well, we thank Andrew for stopping by. That was great. Good luck with to the NHL Street program. Sounds awesome. And now we've got another NHL alumni and a fellow media member now, Sean. He's a media member. Rick Tockett with TNT now. So, Rick, let's start right there. Yeah. How do you like it?
I went to the dark side, boys. it's fun. I'll be honest with you, and I say this sincerely. TNT is a first class operation. They're unreal. Turner Broadcast, the way they want us to kind of portray hockey or talk about it, they want to make sure that, you know, the less than average fan will tune in, right? They don't really want you breaking film down and getting too crazy, like nerdy stuff. And they don't tell you stuff sometimes. My favorite thing is Gretzky. Like, so they'll say, okay, 20 seconds till we're going on. And he'll look and he'll go, what are we doing? And that's my favorite part, because that's what it is. We don't know what we're doing, because, you know, they give you a little bit of a script, but not much. And then they just kind of, you wing it from there. And I think that's what they believe in.
Well, chaos is fun. Like, that's where art's created, right? And you see some of the things that you guys have done. Like, you watch the highlights and you're like, oh, my God, I can't. And usually Biz is right at the forefront.
Yeah, this guy.
And driving the whole thing.
Listen, I knew Biz a little bit from when I was in Arizona. Not a lot, so I'm around. But I've really become close to him this year, hang out a lot. And he is a very, not so much funny guy, he's a very smart guy. People don't realize, you know, he plays that goofy, you know, don't play, you know, fourth line, fifth line hockey player. But he's actually a very smart guy, and he brings a lot. He brings a lot to the table, and enjoyed being around him.
You know, I remember a segment you guys did, I think it was last month, about breaking the sticks, right? You were trying to break sticks, and you couldn't break the stick. You eventually broke it, but it took a little much. He tried to break one over his leg, and I think nearly broke his leg. But that's the fun stuff you're talking about. That just happens, right?
Well, yeah. Liam, we were talking about Rick Bowness. Remember, he was trying to break the stick. Yeah. And he goes, why don't we try to break a stick? And there's different ways to break a stick. You know, I've been on the bench as a coach or a player when you're mad at the coach or mad at somebody. You know, you pitchfork it, and those things snap like that. And I'm like, I couldn't snap that thing off. And I was pissed, I got to tell you. But Anson Carr, he's probably going to be mad at me. And Liam, they had theirs pre-cut. So that's why theirs came off so quick. And me and Biz couldn't.
It did look very clean, that cut. It looked clean, especially Anson's. Looked very clean.
Yeah, Anson's, he's a strong. He's not that strong. but that's the sort of stuff they want you to do. You know, little things like that. Relate to the fans.
You kind of knew going in, because you dealt with the media for your whole career, right? Like, but what about this did you find surprising or harder than you thought?
Well, you know, you gotta have a take. I mean, you can't be, you know, you can't be vanilla. And they asked me, hey, listen, will you be scared? Will you jeopardize, you know, if I say the wrong thing, wrong organization or something, you know, if I want to become a head coach again? And I said, you know, if I could just be honest, like, I mean, you guys know, if you're honest and you have a take, and like, I always got along with the media, because if guy says, hey, talking had a bad game, you know, he's in the dressing room the next day, no problem, I get it. But when it gets personal, that's when it's, you know, that's when it, you know, you guys know more than I do. It'll never be personal with me when I have a take on something. So that was kind of the one thing I was kind of like, you know, a little nervous about. But just look, I try to be honest. Yeah, if I think this team's not playing well, I'll say it. If I think this team could use a trade or something, I'll say it. Like, I got no problem saying it. I don't think that's going to hurt you. I think, you know, people want to hear the honesty.
Yeah, and they can see through it if you're not. Right?
Yeah.
That's the other part. You can easily see through it. But you mentioned coaching. What do you miss about it?
The competition, just the strategy. Like, this is great. I'm having a lot of fun. I mean, it's a great time. But I still, you know, I want to mix it up in there. You know, you want to be in that coach's room. You want to strategize. You're playing this guy's, you know, who should play with who. Who's the goalie tonight? You know, just, you know, certain things. Like, you know, team philosophies, being part of a team. And so I miss that.
But when you watch all these games, and we just asked Andrew the same thing a little bit as being a defenseman, like, when you watch all these games and you see the skill level now, like, it's not as much X's and O's as maybe it was 5 years ago. Do you kind of say, well, I'm glad I don't have to game plan against a Trevor Zegras or a Connor McDavid, or does that get you even more excited because nobody can seem to stop him?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. Listen, Craig Brewery is one of my best friends. We call it hard skill. Like, I'll be honest with you. Yeah, I think we have to promote skill. There are skilled games. But we interviewed Jágr last night. You heard Jágr saying the game's a little bit sometimes too much basketball, too much outside, too much skill. And I know what he was meant. We call it hard skill. I want guys, the Zegras, all those guys. But they got to be able to play inside. They got to be able to do the inside skill stuff too. I'm not saying he doesn't do it. I'm just saying when you don't have that contact or that little bit of mucking and grind, sometimes the games are boring to me. And I think that, you know, if what game the other night I watched, you know, even the Washington-Edmonton game, there were some hits. There was a lot of goals. You know, McDavid scored, Draisaitl scored. There, I think there was a, you know, almost a fight. I don't know. I thought that was a good hockey game. That's what I'd love to watch. So, but definitely today's game, you got to have skill to play this game.
Well, and I asked Andrew this question. He said you got to ask a coach probably better than me. So I'll ask you because you are a coach. The question of what does trust have to develop between coach and player nowadays for the coach to say, just go, just do play your, like, you got skill, use it, do what you want, like a Trevor Zegras trying to do all his things.
Sure.
Or does that have to be, or does the coach just say, you know what, that's the way this guy plays, I'm going to let him go, but then if I see things here and there, I'll have to, you know, not rein him in, but maybe pick apart other aspects of
this game. Mike Solomon, you know, I learned a lot from him, but we talk about this, like, there's certain guys, you know, where's the fence in your backyard? Mm-hmm. Some guys you gotta let them run. So you're gonna put that fence. We're gonna give this guy 3 miles. Like, we're gonna let him do his thing. But there's gotta be a time when you have to corral a guy a little bit, right? You just can't. We don't want to take the stick out of your hands, but you still gotta be part of the team system. So that's a great question, Dan. Like, you gotta be able to give the player what he needs, his piece of the pie, and let him do his thing. But there's also going to be, you got to be calculated. There's going to be some times where you got to stay in the team system. So, and the really good coaches are, you know, that have great players, have great relationships. Like Sidney Crosby, what a pleasure to coach, right? Do I think he could get 25 more points a year? Absolutely. He doesn't cheat the game. He plays the game the right way. He does, you know, you'd like to let him go, just do what you want. But he's the type of guy that wants to be more in a team environment. That's where he's more successful. So I think you're right. You got to look at the player. Certain guys, you got to let them go. And sometimes you got to corral them. And I think good coaches know when to corral guys.
Is it harder because there's not, as a coach, is it harder because there's not that fear as much as there was in the past? Like when you think about the game and you got sent to the minors, right? You messed up.
Wow.
See you in Providence, right? Or I'm going to staple you to the end of the bench. Like the coach was the king.
Mike Keenan called me in. He goes, if you don't have a good game tonight, we have your jersey in Hershey with 22 on it right now. Whoa. And I went out. We played Calgary, and I remember I fought 3 times, and we won the game. He goes, much better, right? So that fear, yeah, that doesn't happen. And also the fear, like, even a coach, like, these players are intelligent guys. They make a lot of money. Like, if you're going to go in there and be a dictator and think that you're going to tell, you know, these guys, hey, you do this, this, that, you can't. You're not going to, you know, it's not a dictatorship. You got to have a partnership with a player. So that's why the communication and the, you know, the cliche open door policy is big in hockey. And you got to coach guys differently.
I remember Alain Vigneault once said about JT Miller when he was a rookie, if he's going to be a really good AHL player one day, right? Which is just, I mean, that's a jab at a guy right there. That's a killer.
Well, he wants him to read, open, yeah, he wants to open the paper.
Yeah,
and,
right.
Yeah, right. See that. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But the, you know, so we ask, talk about trust. What about communication? When you were playing to now, are players much more communicating with the coach? Is there more questions being asked? Are players, you know, in demand more of answers now?
100%.
Yeah.
They want to know why, when. Hey, we're going to this forecheck. We're going to have the F3 a little bit wider in this forecheck tonight. If you don't have a reason why, if you know, back in the day, just do it.
Yeah.
Like Mike Keenan says, we're going to do dot width and you're going to do this. And you're like, okay. Now you're going to get a guy to put up his hand or whatever they're going to say. Well, why? Because, you know, isn't it better if we're a little wider again? We're playing this team because they like to rim the pucks and blah. And sometimes they stump you like, yeah, you're right. Why are we going to this forecheck? Because this team rims the puck more, so maybe we should be wider. So you're going to get a lot more questions and a lot. But we also, like, I'm a guy, when I was coaching, especially Arizona, I want guys to come in my room. I want to go and talk. What do you think here? Hey, do you think we can practice at this time? Because of this, that. And I try to educate the players and give them a game plan for the next week. And then you give it to them, they'll just come back to you and say, hey, that's great, but can we do this? And I like that. And I think if you don't give them that leash, I don't think you're going to get maximize that player. I really don't.
You played with a lot of skilled players throughout your career. I mean, really, really skilled. But when you look at the skill in the NHL today, we're going to see it this weekend, especially on Friday with the skills competition and the breakaway event and some of the other stuff. Do you even recognize the game?
Some of the stuff the guys are doing now is amazing. You know, all the Michigan stuff and whatever. Hey, I could take or leave it. It's great. I love it. But I'm the type of guy, I want to defend it. I want that defenseman to knock that guy in his ass. I got to tell you, that's who I am. But yeah. I do love that part. What I love the guys nowadays, the way they can catch the puck on the fly or from a dead stop to go fast, That's the difference now those guys can do. Like, be able to catch a puck, take the puck around a guy and take it. Like Connor McDavid the other night, Draisaitl. I mean, that's just pure skill and strength. That's what I marvel. And that sort of stuff wins when you do that sort of stuff in the playoffs.
Yeah, and the game's faster as a result of plays like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it definitely is.
Yeah, you're right.
I wanted to ask you about a specific player because you know him, you coached him, coached him for a long time, Phil Kessel.
Yeah.
Right? I don't think he's longed for Arizona this year. Where could Phil Kessel fit in well with his skill set and knowledge and experience and, you know, and maybe go after it again?
See, I love Phil. The thing that bothers me of Phil... is he doesn't shoot the puck enough. And hit like, and he's such... The one thing I've noticed this year, and he's had a really pretty good year for the Coyotes, and I hope for both sakes that he goes somewhere, and I think he's going to get traded. I mean, why wouldn't you? Let the guy go somewhere, and I think Bill Armstrong will. There's a couple of teams, like, you know, for me, like an Anaheim is a team that... They get in. You never know, right? I think they're going to get in because I like their hockey team. But Phil can go in there. The young guys in Arizona love Phil. They'll love him. And he's a scorer that they can use. I'm just using that kind of level
right.
player. You know, you got the Rangers. You know, you got the big boys. You got the Colorados and stuff. Like, the Colorado's looking for a right-handed shot guy, which, you know, I remember talking to Joe Sakic this summer. He was talking about some players he asked me about because he wanted to find a good right-handed shot guy. They lost Donskoy, remember, for the power play. Mm-hmm. You know, whether they can get him, you know, Phil would be a good player there. You know, Boston, you know, maybe back to Boston. You know, teams that are looking for that secondary scoring, a guy that could be that, like he did in Pittsburgh. You know, you had the big guys, and Phil kind of was, what do we do with Phil? Like the other teams, because, you know, you lock down Crosby and Malkin. You know, Gensel at the time was hotter than Firecracker. And Phil just played on that third line. That's why we beat Washington. Phil got to play against the 5-6, and he had a great series. So teams that can, if you know, he doesn't have to be the man, but he can be that second guy in the secondary scoring would be big.
We always talk about the players as the trade deadline approaches. It's one of, and for the media, it's one of the most exciting times of the year.
Yeah.
What about for a coach?
For
a coach, what's the trading? Like, when you're an active coach and you need something or you're afraid you're going to lose something, what's that period like when you show up at the rink every day?
Yeah, well, that's why the GM and the coaches together, I look at the GM-coach combo. You know, like, hey, this guy's a great coach. And, like, Doug Armstrong, Craig, I love that. So Craig Berube, and I'm not going to – I don't know for sure, but – they talk every day. What do they need? I think they need a defenseman. You know, so that's the one thing when coaches go in, you got to be very communicative with your GM. You can't always say, I want this, I want that. But I think you have to be communicative with your GM. Say, listen, I think we really need this part of, you know, this guy or whether it's this part of our team. So the communication between the two GMs are huge every day, especially coming to the trading deadline. And the coaches nowadays, I think, are more involved in the trade deadline process they did back in the day.
Yeah. Do you look forward to it more as a TNT analyst or as a coach, the trade deadline?
I'm going to say as an analyst.
Yeah.
Because I can, you know, I can play fantasy camp, you know.
Right.
If you have a fantasy, you know, I can hey, if they get this guy and this guy, and I heard about this trade. Whereas a coach, you know, you're just more, you know, you kind of know the truth more. Because sometimes you're talking to GM and he goes, hey, we're looking at this guy. And I've been in the room where we thought we had a deal and never, you know, it didn't pan out. And you're as a coach, you're like, man, like, couldn't get that guy. You know, you walk out of there. And that's the worst part is when the GM calls you that day, we didn't get him. You know, and you already, in your mind, got him penciled in. But, yeah, it's the trade deadline is going to be a lot of fun. We're going to start, what is it, 6 more weeks or something?
Yeah, March 21st.
Yeah. And you know what? I believe the trade deadline, I think there's going to be more deals 2 weeks before. I don't think there's going to be many on trade deadline day. And now that Jimmy Rutherford's back in, he's going to start to – I love Jimmy. He's going to be amping this whole thing up. He might be the first guy to start the dominoes.
Or everybody else is going to be afraid of him starting the dominoes, and they're going to go first.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, Jimmy's the perfect guy, and he's not afraid to tell you, hey, this is what I'm looking for. I like the, you know, you can't tamper, but this is what we're looking for. Yeah. And that he's good for the league, Jimmy.
I got one more question for you, because they're rolling. Well, they lose a few games here, but the Pittsburgh Penguins, I was an idiot before the season. I said, I think Pittsburgh might not make it this year. It might be over, right? You know, Crosby's hurt. Malkin's going to be out for a couple of months. Hey, you look at them, and they're just, you know, I mean, okay, recently 0-1-3 in their last four, but they're rolling. You work directly with Mike Sullivan. Describe him as a coach, because it seems to me that no matter who they put on the ice, they're fine.
Yeah. Before I get into Mike, we're sponsored by DraftKings. I think a month ago I said this. I swear I said, if I was a betting man, I would take Pittsburgh Penguins to get to the Stanley Cup Finals. I think it was like 50-1 or something, 41. And they went on this tear. This team is a good hockey team, right? Jarry is the question mark. You know, he's an all-star. But can he be an all-star in April? And that's going to be the key, and that's the question. But for Mike Sullivan, what I love about Mike is he has a game plan. And players buy in. There's going to be some pushback sometimes. And Mike can be a little bit of a bully, which I love. Like, he's not going to kowtow to some of the guys. But he's got a great relationship with the big guys. They know his style of play. It works in Pittsburgh. And you're right, Dan. Like, anytime there's a major rash of injuries, they still stay in there. You know, they still, you know, it's a system. He plays a north-south style. They play, they're very detailed. If you watch the way they play, they're detailed. And I think that, and he's lucky, and I'll be honest, and Mike will tell you, like, he's lucky he's got a leadership group that he has.
I'm going to ask you one, Pittsburgh 1-2, and then we'll let you go. And this is not a pet peeve, but something that I believe in strongly. If Sid and Malkin weren't there, do you think Chris Letang would have a higher profile than he does?
I love Chris Letang. Like, last year they were talking about trading from, like, you know, and I was in Arizona. I said to Bill, let's get that. We aren't going to win, but I said, I want Chris Letang if he was on the market. He doesn't get, listen, I don't even know his name was on the Olympic team. Like, I would have him on the Olympic team, those 10 guys or whatever. That's how good I think he is, how good he's played. Yeah, okay, the odd time he throws a pizza up the middle, whatever, but the series is against Washington, when we beat him. I remember those two series, they were grueling. He went head-to-head with Ovechkin, played 29 minutes, not only got points, he was getting run by Ovechkin. He'd get back up. I got a soft spot for him because I think he's one of the top defensemen in the league, and still. And I think the Penguins, I don't think they can let him go. I mean, hopefully, you know, I was actually golfing with Mero the other day, and we were talking about that. He goes, well, we got to get a friendly deal, though, if we're going to sign him, type of thing. But he's the type of guy that I'd like to see him stay in Pittsburgh.
Well, from golfing with Mario Lemieux to us, talking to us. Appreciate it, Talk. Thanks for coming by, all right?
Have fun, guys. Appreciate it.
All right.
Man, it was great talking to Rick Tocchet. He does such a good job on the TNT broadcast and still so in touch with the game. But speaking of in touch with the game, we're going to move right on. We have Mike McKenna here, friend of the show, been on a few times. Talks a lot of goalies, has a lot of history here in Vegas. Mike, great for you to join us. We really appreciate it. We know it was a trek to get out here, so we're going to put you to work now.
Oh, good. I'm happy for that. You know what? It's appropriate that I'm following Talk, because today happened to be the 13-year anniversary of the first game I ever played in the National Hockey League,
really?
When Rick Tocchet was my head coach with the Tampa Bay Lightning. So I know you guys did that on purpose to give the best segue we could ever imagine, and I got a strange relationship with the city of Vegas in some ways. You know, I started my pro career here in the ECHL and then came back to do broadcasting for 2 years with the Golden Knights, and now coming back for an all-star game. It's really cool.
All right, there's so much to unpack right there, but the one thing that I want to unpack first is your first game, the memories of your first. I love hearing the memories of a guy's first game. So what was your first game?
Total surprise. I was on an American Hockey League contract playing for the Norfolk Admirals. I didn't even go to training camp in Tampa Bay. I have blue, yellow, and red equipment. It looks like a Sunoco billboard. And I was on an American League deal.
Yeah.
There's no chance of me getting called up to the Tampa Bay Lightning, who happened to be black, blue, and silver. Well, I happened to play pretty well that season. Olaf Kolzig goes down for the year with an injury. The team's not good that season. It was actually when Barry Melrose had been head coach and was let go early in the year. It was a tough season in Tampa. And the whole plan was they wanted to have Kari Ramo, my goalie partner in Norfolk, continue to develop. So they were going to call me up to sit on the bench behind Mike Smith and maybe play 3 or 4 games the rest of the year. This was in February. Well, I show up, Mike Smith's concussed, Olaf Kolzig's out, and all of a sudden it's me and Kari Ramo. And I've never played a minute NHL hockey. Training camp, preseason, anything. and I'm dressing my first NHL game in Long Island in the snowstorm, and there's 7,000 people there. Like, there were more fans in Hershey a couple nights before when I went in. Huge snowstorm. And we get to the second period, and this is like hero worship at this point. I can't believe what's going on, you know. Bill Guerin's on the other side, and, well, we scored, you know, the Islanders scored three really quick goals on Kari Rahmo. And when you back up in Long Island, you sit in the corner with the fans. Mm-hmm. Well, I see Rick Tocchet, and I look at the bench sheepishly. You know, I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, this might actually happen. Like, I may end up in this game. And Tock is waving over the crowd to me in the corner. And I can sense it, and I go, oh, man, it's happening. He's waving me to come into a National Hockey League game. And that's how it happened. I came in midway through the second period. I stopped all 11 shots. I handled the puck a little bit. And I thought, man, like, I did it. You know, I mean, I came off the ice, and the moment I'll never forget was taking my jersey off to put it into the laundry bin after the game. And I just looked at it and just, I couldn't believe it. You know, I'd had a journey where I started in the ECHL as a free agent there, and then played a year in the American League, and another half year later I was in the NHL. And it was pretty unbelievable. And then I started the next night in Pittsburgh. So that was a big wake-up call. First shot of that game was Crosby on a 2-on-1 that I did stop. But I also failed to stop Evgeny Malkin and two other Pittsburgh players, and we lost 4-3 in overtime the next night.
It must have been so weird because the world's changed so much in that time. Like, now guys make their debut and their parents have the package or they're able to get in or whatever. Nobody saw yours, right? Because there was no package. There was a snowstorm. You couldn't get your mom and dad in. Like, it happened in a vacuum.
Yeah, it happened really quick. And so nobody was there. The game in Pittsburgh, my girlfriend, now wife, she did make it along with another family friend. But I was also too old for an entry-level contract. So, and Tampa at the time, I can't say that they were spending a lot of money because my parents were not flown in for that game. And so, and that's written in now, and to see, you know, your parents get that ticket if you're on entry level, blah, blah, blah. And so, but they were at my next start in Tampa, and they got to see it. I actually saw my first win, which was a shutout. And that never happened again. Everything went downhill from there. So, so it was a pretty unbelievable start to my NHL career. And like I say, it just kind of spiraled from there, but it was pretty cool.
You know, you mentioned that, you know, you played here in, you know, that you played here in Vegas. You've done work here in Vegas now post-career. You look at what's going on here. We're at Fanfare right now. You know, people are around. It's going to get busier as the weekend goes on. The NHL All-Star Game is in Las Vegas, because there's a team in Las Vegas, not just because the league wanted to throw it, get a game in Vegas because players would want to go there. It's because there's a team here, and it's become like a crown jewel, you know, of the National Hockey League in such a short period of time. What do you make of that? Like, how has this happened?
It's hard for me to believe at times, but when I really look at it from the macro sense, I really shouldn't be surprised. You know, I've spent a lot of time, when I played for the Wranglers in the ECHL here, trying to convince myself the NHL wouldn't work for various reasons, because I just wasn't sold that this market was going to be into hockey, straight up, you know. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we had a good fan base at the ECHL level, 5,000 plus, but that's kind of your niche market. And I think in that time frame, from when I played in 2005 to 7 to when the Golden Knights came into the league in 2018, I guess it was now. So I'm trying to
17-18
when they came into the league. The city of Vegas had grown up a lot in population, in everything. And I'm still not sure, though, if the Golden Knights don't take off the way they do because of the most unfortunate of incidents in American history, the mass shooting that occurred at Route 91 Country Festival that happened here. When you speak to people in this city, and I've gotten to be friends with so many that live here, people of this city rallied around the Golden Knights. You know, there had never been a professional team here. And the way the team handled it, the response, Derek Englund's speech, and then from that point, Marc-Andre Fleury becoming the face of the city with how he played. An absolutely unbelievable season for him and the rest of the team. Gerard Gallant leads them to the Stanley Cup Finals. It was just a magical season, and it captivated an entire city. And I'm not sure if it all galvanizes around the team if that doesn't happen in the most morbid of ways. And now it is. It is something that is ingrained with Vegas people that, hey, this is our team. This is when you go to the game, they always put up on the big screen about midway through, and it goes through all these different machinations, and it goes tourists, and people cheer if they're a tourist. Mm-hmm. And you go, ah. Well, then it goes locals, and it's, ah. You know, it's, dude, it's like crazy loud because it is. It is a locals market here, and I didn't believe it would be. And that's what it's turned into. That's why it's magical here, and that's why you'll see 10 years from now youth hockey is going to be putting players first, second rouners out to the NHL draft. There's already been some, but there will be even more coming down the road.
Has the feeling changed a little bit, though, here? Because for so long it was, well, we have this team, we're going to embrace them through thick or thin, and it was thick really quickly. But now there's an expectation almost. Like, there's no more runway of, oh, okay, try and be good. Like, they're a real team now. Like, they have a history, and the fans are hungry.
It went from being, we're going to hope we're competitive the first couple of years and win a Stanley Cup by our fifth or sixth year, to it's win now every year. We will, this is our motive, our mission. We have to win no matter what. We will chase every shiny object. We will do whatever it takes to get the best players. And I think that's been a very hard transition for fans here, realistically. And it's, I think, even to a certain extent for the players as well. You know, that first year was just a really, like, magical group. You know, you had a bunch of underdogs, castaways, and prospects, and people that hadn't had the chance to prove themselves in the league. Well, you've got full-blown superstars here now. And it has changed that dynamic. I mean, people here were hurt when Marc-Andre Fleury left. They really were. That's affected the dynamic in the building. But I think at the core of it, again, when I speak to people, it always circles back that it's still their team. It's still the Golden Knights' crest. So it is a little bit different. It doesn't have that same whimsical effect. But if they win a Stanley Cup, and with the aggressiveness they've shown, you can't help but admire it, man. Like, you got to go for it.
Yeah, they're not the Golden Misfits anymore.
They
are not. Guess,
well, right? They still have one line.
They got one line.
They
is.
Do.
That
Jonathan Marchessault, Riley Smith, and William Karlsson is still the original Misfit line.
That's true. They are. But first off, I look at them, and it's like it's gone from hopefully we win the Stanley Cup by year six or seven to I can't believe we haven't won the Stanley Cup yet.
Right.
You know, and it's just a short period of time. But they have a guy coming who may very well be the best player that they've never had, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, in Jack Eichel. How – because you do work on our side now for Daily Faceoff.
Sure.
So
yep.
How does Jack Eichel, in your opinion, impact what Vegas is doing here? Because there's a trickle-down effect, and then we obviously know there's a cap trickle-down effect as well, that there's going to be probably have to be a move made here. But when you add a player like Jack, how do you think this team handles that trickle-down effect?
Well, he makes the team more dynamic, if you ask me. The way he can skate with the puck and what he can do with it on the power play, his mobility is really going to add a new dimension to the team that I don't think has been there. They're a very structured team. They're a fast team. But at their core, the Golden Knights are really a rush team. That's where they've generated most of their offense. Mm-hmm. And I would expect Eichel will help their power play. I think he can find seam passes much easier than what the current personnel has been so far, at least showed on the ice. And I like when he plays in motion with the puck. I mean, when I played against him the few games, that was always what I noticed right away was, man, this guy's big and he can skate and he makes me nervous. I don't know whether he's shooting or passing this thing down the wing. And so you take all those attributes and you factor it into extrapolating it out and thinking, where does he fit in the lineup? Well, first line center.
Right.
Well, Chandler Stephenson's having a career year for the Golden Knights. He's been phenomenal, but he's traditionally not been a first line guy. And then you've got William Karlsson on this, what's considered the second line, the misfit line with Smith and Marchessault. So where do you put Stephenson now? And then you got Nolan Patrick and Brett Houghton and Nick Waugh. Like, it's a team that's really loaded with centermen. I would expect this club to end up with Eichel as one, Karlsson as two, Stephenson as three. And if you're asking me, I love Nick Waugh as a centerman. That's where I would put him. So it's going to have to shake out, but I also think that those lines could be predicated by any moves that may have to happen.
Right.
You know, you have the salary cap looming as the Golden Knights. And, you know, morbidly, there's probably almost a hope that somebody goes on IR, Kucherov style.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to lose.
Absolutely.
So you don't have to lose somebody. Because if you got to clear $6 million or $5 million of cap space, I mean, you're looking at a Dodonov or a Riley Smith who's been here forever. He's a pending UFA. Mm-hmm. It's going to be hard to make that call because there's not that many ancillary pieces. There's not that many depth pieces. You'd have to move out two or three of those to make that happen. So it's going to be a chore for Kelly McCrimmon and George McPhee here to find that magic combination to make room for Jack Eichel.
Do you believe when it all shakes out that there are cup finals?
Yeah, maybe. We're halfway through the year, and I think there's 10 teams that could be cup finalists. There's so much parity in the top half of the league. I think out of the West, absolutely. The way they handled Colorado last year in playoffs, I mean, that gives you confidence in the future. You know, we took care of them last year. We can do it again. I mean, Colorado's steamrolling right now. But Vegas has managed to be a good team despite injuries and COVID early on and everything. They've managed to fight through that. So I think they're without a question you're looking at a top dog in the West. But a team like Minnesota, that was an amazing series between Minnesota and Vegas last year. Went 7 games. And Minnesota's better this year than they were last year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I feel like Minnesota's a little under the radar right now, but they've won 9 of their last 10 games. Yeah. And St. Louis is lurking, too. So I think when it shakes out, Vegas should come out of the West. I believe that. But you can never tell what's going to happen with chemistry when you bring in such an important piece like Eichel, who also, by the way, hasn't played hockey in a really long time.
Yeah.
And he had major neck surgery. So there's a lot of unknowns, but they've battled through a lot of that this year. It's a resilient group.
You know, the couple of teams you mentioned there, it's still, maybe less so with Vegas, but you wonder about Colorado with the goaltending. We know how important goaltending is. So let's talk goaltending.
Sure, that's what I'm here for.
This is what you want, right?
Been waiting with bated breath.
All right, so let's talk goaltending. I'm going to ask you your opinion. We're at the All-Star break now. Who is your Vezina Trophy winner right now?
UC Saros, and everybody in New York City is going to throw a pie at me for that. And I'm going to tell you why, though, because UC Saros really last year cemented his role as the glue of the Nashville Predators for me. That team wasn't great last year, and he carried them. And I thought he should have been in the Vezina Trophy finalist candidate last year. I really believe that. And, you know, this year things in Nashville are much better. I think the depth players like Tanner Janot have almost guilted the top players into playing harder, heavier. John Hines has done a great job. But Saros has played a lot of games. I think he's played 37 games, has 23 wins. His traditional numbers, his advanced numbers, they're all rock solid. Igor Shesterkin, though, has been the best goalie in the National Hockey League this year. The only reason I can't put him as the top guy for the Vezina is because he's played less games. I think he's played 27 games. He does have 21 wins.
Right.
But when you look for a Vezina winner, it's got to be somebody that plays the bulk of games for me. So by the end of the season, this could easily even out. You know, maybe Saros misses some games here or there. Maybe Shesterkin just plays everything. And if he continues to play at the pace that he has, Shesterkin, if he's over a .930 save percentage, I mean, he's at like a .937 now. He's going to be the guy to beat. But if we're handing out right now, I'm going Saros. And I think there should be a big mask tip to Tristan Jarry, who undercover was amazing for Pittsburgh this year and answered a lot of questions about his game. But the Penguins have their lineup back. They got most of the big dogs back in the lineup. I think that the load is going to come off Jarry a little bit. It'll be a bit easier for him in the second half of the season.
So you just mentioned Shesterkin as a Vezina finalist. The guy who's won the last two Vezinas is Vasilevsky. There's Russian goalies everywhere in this league now. When you broke in, they were hard to find.
Yeah.
What's been the difference?
Well, they come over and they're very mature in their game. And they've received quality coaching while in Russia. They understand the mechanics and the concepts of playing within your crease and having proper routes to your post and not ending up flailing around in the white ice, a lot of them. But I think that the Russians across the board possess this athleticism that a lot of American and North American Canadian goaltenders don't have. I think that North American goaltenders have been so overcoached at goalie camps that they've turned back into robots like they were for a while. We don't see the creativeness out of them as often. We don't see what Vasilevsky can do going behind his back to make a save as often from the North American set. And I don't really know the reasons for this with the Russian training. I haven't delved into it. I mean, I was teammates with Sergei Bobrovsky. I saw his routines, and they were very unique, lots of stretching and mobility things. But they have that added athleticism, a lot of them, to me. You know, Shesterkin's just rock solid in how he plays. But Bobrovsky and Vasilevsky, boy, they've got the athleticism and they have the mental athleticism to do so. They're just very creative in the goal. And that's the difference for me between a good goaltender and a truly great goaltender in the NHL.
Well, and you look, a part of it too is being able to play the puck, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a huge part of it right now, especially with how fast the game is and how quickly we want to transition. The other night against Florida at Madison Square Garden, I'm at the game, Igor Shesterkin comes out, the puck's in the air. He kind of punches it out of the, with his blocker and glove together, punches it to Artemi Panarin. Bang, the Rangers go on a rush, and Chris Kreider scores on the other end. And Kreider gives the point down to Shesterkin. He doesn't get an assist on the play because it went Panarin to, I think, Strom to Kreider. But he started the play. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you've seen more of in just in terms of maybe even the Russian goalies too? Playing the puck, playmaking.
The Russian goalies never used to be able to handle the puck. That's new. Okay.
Right.
So that was not common. But Shesterkin is one of the better ones in the NHL. He's very good at it. I mean, when he came up from Hartford in the American League, everybody thought this guy's going to score a goal. He tried about four times in the American League.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think he's tempered that a little bit now for task at hand. But when you talk about transition, it really is about having a goaltender that they're not going to make a 95-foot pass. You're looking to make 10, 15, 20-foot smart passes hard tape to tape. You know, and Mike Smith in Edmonton is still the benchmark for puck handlers, but he's more than what most people can do. You don't have to be Mike Smith, but you have to be efficient. Like, if you go to scout kids that are 17, 18 years old, if they can't handle the puck, I don't want them. If I'm picking. And now, puck handling was a baby of mine. I loved it. And I scored a goal when I was 17. This is the best moment of my life, okay, at that stage of the game. But I just, as I got older, it became about being efficient. And you see that with the Russians now. You see, you know, that they're willing to get out and do that. But I think it matters. You know, I mean, I look at Detroit. Nedeljkovic is a phenomenal puck handler, and Thomas Greiss is okay. Mm-hmm. You know, and in transition, even Chicago. Lankanen's not a great puck handler. Marc-Andre Fleury is a very good puck handler. Those are attributes that matter to me. Tristan Jarry, same way, way better than Casey DeSmith with the puck. So I could probably make arguments for all the players, the goalies that I like that handle it well, for the reason that it was my thing. But I really think it adds an extra element to your D. And plus, the D don't get the wear and tear. If you can make a pass like that, they're not taking hits behind the net. They like that. They don't land to take hits behind the net if they can help it.
So I'm going to put you on the spot here a little bit. I know you watch a lot of Vegas games, but you watch a lot of St. Louis games because mm-hmm. you're back in St. Louis, your hometown. Great city. Is there a goalie controversy there?
I wouldn't call it a controversy. I actually think it's something similar to what the Golden Knights faced last year with having Fleury and Leonard. And I believed it to be a strength during the regular season, but it needs to shake itself out come playoff time because Ville Husso right now has been absolutely phenomenal. And Jordan Binnington, to me, carried the mail in St. Louis early in the season when they were very loose defensively, and they've been loose all season, really. But I think Binnington's just hit a lull, okay? I trust that he will be fine. You know, I really believe in Dave Alexander, the goalie coach in St. Louis. I think he's one of the premier guys in the league. You know, I worked with him in Syracuse in the American League. He's outstanding. He understands Binnington's game. The part that I can't understand is why the Blues are playing better in front of Husso right now. And this is not to take anything away from Ville Husso, who has grabbed this opportunity and run with it. Because last year, I don't think the Blues trusted Husso last year. His first periods, they weren't great, didn't start games on time. And that's all that's done this year. He has been great from the start of the game. So, you know, he's a UFA, pending UFA, Husso is. Binnington's got 5 years left at $6 million.
Yeah.
You know, they need Binnington to work in St. Louis. And I'm sure they'd like to keep Husso as well. But I think at this stage, Craig Berube will always play the person he thinks is going to win him hockey games. You know, this is a lot like when Binnington came on the scene, wins a couple games, goes on a big roll, and supplants Jake Allen, who was a good goaltender for the St. Louis Blues. I think it's similar to that. When we get to playoff time, I still believe Jordan Binnington will be the guy there. That's what I believe. But if Ville Husso keeps ripping off what he's doing right now, Craig Berube will play him. And I don't think it's a controversy. I think it's a strength. But you get closer to playoffs, and yeah, there's going to be a lot more chatter about this one.
Yeah. No.
Just to follow up on that really quick. As a goalie, what's that like? Because Binnington knows, right? He did it. He did it to Jake Allen. He took his job, and he became an NHLer. And now he looks across, and he sees a kid that's coming for his job. And we always talk about being a good teammate and helping your partner out. But when you've lived it on one end and now you see it coming on the other end, how do you process that as a goalie?
Expectations are not easy. Expectations are tough. And that's what comes with a big contract. That's what comes with the, you know, winning previously. But you can always draw upon that, too. I mean, Jordan Binnington carried the Blues to a Stanley Cup. You cannot just walk out and find somebody off the street or in the American League or the ECHL that's done that very often. And so you draw from it, but it does give you pause. And it makes you a little nervous. And sometimes a little nervousness is a good thing. Now, some people handle it better than others. I've seen goaltenders that have, you know, gotten a similar scenario where somebody comes along and you just see him spiral. And you think, man, like, this guy was so good. What happened? And they can't handle the pressure of it, of the moment, of the contract, of all of those things weighing on them. Yet others thrive on it. Some love being the underdog, you know, and that's going to be Jordan Binnington's biggest challenge, is to just be the underdog again. And he's done that before. All he's going to do is forget about his contract. Yeah. Forget about, you know, just go. That's all he's got to do. Listen, I'll give it. This is quick. I'm long-winded. I know it. But, like, Ty Conklin, a former NHL goaltender, at one point I was struggling, and I called him. And he goes, man, you need to just go out there and not give up. Like, just not care. And I was like, man, that is the simplest advice I've ever gotten. But he just told me to go out and not care, which – most people would think goalies, what do you mean? Like, they think goalies live in this vacuum where you come to the rink 9 hours before, you don't talk to anybody, and you're this weirdo in the corner. And I'm really trying to get that out of hockey, because goalies need to be teammates, you know?
Yeah, I understand. All right, last one from me, and I'm going to put you on the spot. If it's March 21st, if his team has a game, what team is Marc-Andre Fleury playing for on March 21st that night?
In my heart of hearts, in my best guesses of guesses, I don't think Marc-Andre Fleury is going to move at the deadline.
Think he wants to stay in Chicago? Family, all that stuff?
I think it's going to have to be the most compelling of situations, given how he values where his family is, and especially currently task at hand. You know, I mean, his interviews have all been the right thing. Like, we're still trying here in Chicago. You know, he has pride. But I don't know. I know there's teams that have been interested. I mean, I'm sure a team like Washington right now would love to have Marc-Andre Fleury. What's it going to take to convince him to come? You know, are you going to be away from your family for 3 months? Is that worth it? You know, how do you make this happen? So maybe I'm being pessimistic here. I also look at the factor that there hasn't been a trade deadline acquisition goaltender that's helped a team win a Stanley Cup in forever. And the closest that I can remember was Dwayne Roloson for the Edmonton Oilers in, help me out here, guys, 2006.
Yeah.
And that was my friend Tyrone Conklin, who had to come in and do a little cleanup duty because Dwayne Roloson was injured. He carried the team to the finals that year. Those moves don't pay off very often. You have to give up a lot for it. So push comes to shove, I'm guessing he doesn't go. But if there's any team out there to me that at this stage could use him, I think Wash could. And I think if anything happens to either Kemper or Francouz in Colorado, that's a team that would be looking very hard at a Marc-Andre Fleury.
You stole my question a little bit, or you dampened my question a little bit, but I'm going to go. I'm going to go anyways.
We'll hash it out later tonight. We can do that.
I'm not going to care. I'm going to take Ty Conklin's advice. Who is the goalie out there that if you were a contender – you would say, I'm going to go all in on this guy at the trade deadline?
Well, I think Marc-Andre is that guy with his pedigree and his and just the weight that he carries when he comes into a locker room. You know, and I look at his game. It's not like he, you know, it was hard in Chicago at first. I mean, I don't know if I've seen a worse 5-on-5 team at for the first month of that year. The way that teams were just snapping pucks across the ice in the defensive zone of the Blackhawks, was no goalie had a chance on that. But he has been really good since then. And he's taken some things into his game that he's incorporated. He's doing a post-integration called overlap now that he hadn't done previously that's helped him out. And I see a drive there. I see competitiveness. And that's where I think he could still make that difference. Could Semyon Varlamov be somebody who's available? I think he's got $5 million left, 1 year left on his deal. There's some cost certainty there. Maybe. You know, I even think, though, that if you're somebody who's looking for depth, how about Anton Forsberg in Ottawa? How about, I mean, Samuel Montembeau in Montreal, you know? If you're Florida, I mean, Spencer Knight has been up and down this year. Do they need somebody that's a depth goalie? It may not be that starting goalie. It may just be the security blanket that's acquired at the trade deadline. And that's where I look for those value deals. Forsberg, I think he's at $750, and Montembeau on a cheap deal. Those may be the type of deals that can help you down the road to at least give you the confidence in your room that, hey, we got two or three guys that could potentially win us if we have to.
Mike, great stuff. Really appreciate it. Check your stuff out on Daily Faceoff, of course. And we got Tom Galitti waiting over there. He's been waiting so patiently the whole time.
My
so.
Old buddy, Tom.
So we'll get him in. Mike, thanks so much for hopping
Anytime.
On with us. All right?
Thanks for having me. Yeah. It was a pleasure.
Well, we teased it. We thank Mike. Great stuff. But, Tom, you've been waiting. You've been waiting to sit in the chair and have a chat with us. It's good to see you.
I thought I was going to end up like Matt Damien on the Jimmy Kimmel Show, and I was never going to get on.
We would never do that to you. We would never do that to you. But we did watch you pace for a while. So I got to start where Mike left off. I asked him about the trade deadline at the end and who that goalie is going to be and – you know, what's going to happen at the deadline. And he mentioned the Capitals, the team that you cover, and that there might be a need there. What are your thoughts on their goaltending situation?
I think that they probably are looking and need to look at whether they can get an upgrade on what they have. With you know, they have two young guys in Ilya Samsonov and Vitek Vanacek, and there's been some inconsistency there. There's been there's a period where Ilya Samsonov played really well and looked like he was going to run with the ball, but then he dropped off, and then Vanacek actually played really well the last month or so, then he just unfortunately got hurt in the game in Pittsburgh. So I think they feel like they, you know, they look at their team and they have Alex Ovechkin, who's 36, and Nicklas Backstrom is, I think, 34, and they have some aging guys, and they have to take advantage of what, you know, they're still a pretty good team. They're a good team. They played well most of this year through a lot of injuries and stuff. So I think when you have that situation, you have to make sure that you have the goalie who can help you. They're going to look for a goalie who can help them.
And to me, that guy is only Marc-Andre Fleury. You know, because you mentioned it, right, Tom? Like, you got to get an upgrade from what Samsonov is. Other than Fleury, I mean, Mike mentioned Semyon Varlamov. He comes with term on his right. deal. He would be an upgrade, too. Other than that, I don't know that there is an upgrade for 100% certainty that you could get.
Yeah, I don't. It'll be interesting to see if anybody else comes available. You know, there was, like, the suggestion, though, maybe Braden Holtby could come back. But we don't know what's going on with him in Dallas. His contract is 1 year. Do they hold on to... Does Dallas re-sign him or something like that? Because they're still in contention for a playoff spot there, too. So, there aren't that many guys. And you, like you said, Fleury would be the main guy and be the obvious guy. Be interesting to see. You know, he controls things in his situation with his contract. If he wants to be traded or not, does he want to come? You know, I know Mike said he doesn't think he wants to go anywhere. Would he go to Washington to go, you know, go head-to-head with the guys who are like his brothers, like Sidney Crosby and Chris Letang? Would he do that? That's a good question. That's a question I don't know if it's going to be. We'll find out the answer, I guess, in a month or so.
I would think he's so competitive, and he feels slighted, perhaps, with what happened in Pittsburgh, that he would embrace that opportunity.
I don't know if he feels as slighted with Pittsburgh. I'm on him. Mike knows him much better. But I think if he had the opportunity to go to Colorado and go take out Vegas, I think he might like that one a little more than the one in Washington.
And that's the thing. To me, Washington is an enticing opportunity. If with Marc-Andre Fleury being in control, it's enticing because you get a chance to play with, forget about playing against who you're playing, you get a chance to play with Alex Ovechkin and Nicklas Backstrom. He's the guy who got to play with Sidney Crosby and Evgeny Malkin, now get a chance to play with Ovechkin and Backstrom, be terrific. But then you look at Colorado, and if you want to go try to win a Stanley Cup again, and you're saying where could you go that you have the best chance, well, that's Colorado. I like Washington. But Colorado's got a better chance right now, I think, of winning the Stanley Cup than Washington does.
I think with the right goalie, Colorado has probably the best team in the league. I don't know if that, you know, we'll see if Darcy Kuemper can be that guy for them if they don't make a trade. I think that's what they're trying to figure out. I don't know if Colorado has figured out that out yet. They still have a little more time. Washington, I think, can win the Cup with the right goalie, with Fleury. You know, I think they have some good pieces there, but it'll have to fall into place for them like it fell into place for them in 2018.
One of the reasons when we were planning this mega cast that we're doing here that we wanted to have you on was because Ovi was coming, and he's had such a great year, and now Ovi's not here because of COVID, and that's kind of been the story of our season a little bit. But I wanted to talk to you a little bit about it. I don't think people appreciate what's happening with Alex Ovechkin this year enough because we're so worn out by him, right? Like, he's great for so long that it just becomes something that you take for granted. what he's doing this year and what lays ahead as we come out of the All-Star break and we go towards the end of the regular season are some things that are almost unimaginable.
Yeah, well, he's closing in on moving into third in goals, which think about that. He's 7 goals behind Jaromir Jagr right now. He passes him. There'll be 2 guys ahead of him. There'll be Gordie Howe and there'll be Wayne Gretzky. Like, I don't know if it's even hit him that's, you keep on asking him every time he passes somebody, which has happened already, like, a lot. In the year of 2021, he passed Marcel Dion, he passed Brett Hull, he passed Luke Robe. He passed, like, 5 guys in the calendar year. It was crazy. So it was, it's amazing what he's been doing. And this year, and it's not like he's not like just some guy who's hung around and is doing this later in his career. He's got 29 goals this year. He's among the league leaders in points and in assists. He's having one of the best years of his career. Like, he had slowed down a little bit before the break here, but he's having one of the best years of his career, and he's doing it in his 17th season.
I think he's finally embraced the race, too. Pat, do you believe? Like, do you think he's embraced going after this record?
He did, in my opinion, when he signed the 5-year contract this past summer, where he just said, like, it was set up. The contract was obviously set up for him to take a run at the record. And he said, yeah, I'm going to try to do it. Before that, I don't know if he believed until the last couple of years or so that he really had a chance to do it. And now I think he's like, hey, I can do this. And, so now he's having a season where he could score 50 goals again. And, like, who does that in their 17th season? There aren't many guys. There's not many guys. I think he would be the oldest. From what I check with our great people at NHL Stats, he would be the oldest player ever to score 50 goals if he does it this year. He could be the oldest player to ever lead the league in goals. Like, things like that. Like, he's not – if he's slowed down, it's he's found other ways to make up for it to be still one of the dominant goal scorers in our game.
And when you look at the guys he's chasing, their numbers weren't there in the 37, 38, 39 years. Like, you look at Gretzky's goal totals in those years, and I know he was more of a setup man then, and he was more interested in assists. He didn't shoot as much. But that production fell off exponentially.
Yeah, usually.
And it hasn't here.
Usually when a guy gets older, you expect that to happen, right? Alex is one of those, he's a special guy because he's not slowing down, You'd expect. We were talking years ago. Like, he had, I think, in 2016-17, he scored like 34 goals or something like that. And I thought, oh, Alex is slowing down. And then next year, 49, then 50. Then he was going to score 50 again the year when, unfortunately, COVID hit the first time. Like, so he's. I think one of the things is that he really worked on his off-season training. He committed himself to to being in better shape or timing the way he is in shape for the season and the strength and things that he works on. One of the things I think last year that hurt him was that with the season starting at a weird time with the pandemic, he really didn't know how to time it. And I think he did his training like a normal off season last summer and hit the ground running and right at the start. And you saw it in his game. There was jump in a step that I didn't think was there last year, and it's pretty much been there all year. So,
The thing that impresses me the most about him this year is the Capitals had, and this was going into the game last night, Wednesday against the Oilers, 177 man games lost to injury. Backstrom's missed a ton. Oshie's missed a ton. Mantha's missed a ton. And until last night against Edmonton, he had played in every game, right? And he had been putting up these numbers despite some of these top guys on the team not being there.
Yeah, he was there before last night. He was their only player who hadn't missed a game this season. And they played games where they were missing, like, 5 of their top 9, who you thought would be their top 9 forwards, and he was playing, and Kuznetsov was playing, or when Kuznetsov was out at one point, he was, playing with Lars Eller, because it just, with the COVID, a lot of teams have gone through it, but with them and their injuries, they've had some key guys out. They really haven't had Oshie for most of the season, and that's a big part of their power play. And Backstrom, like you said, missed something like 35 of the first 38 games between his hip and illnesses and stuff like that. So they haven't had their team all year, except for him, and he's driven it.
So I think it was Monday or Tuesday. I forget the days. When you're in Vegas, you never know what day it is or what came before. But we sent you to Pittsburgh for the Ovi Sid show. Sid was going and is going for 500 goals. Ovi was going for 30 this year again, which is almost a low benchmark. But did it feel like 10 years ago being in Pittsburgh, the way those two teams went at each other, Hammer and Tonks?
That was a good game. It was a crazy game. I was talking actually last night to Brian McClellan, the general manager, and I said it reminded me of some of those games they had a few years ago, and it just was the Capitals maybe were not as sharp the first two periods, but it was like one team you know scored a goal, the other team pushed back and scored a goal. It was a fun back and forth game. Penguins played really well, actually. The Capitals have showed me something, though, because they kind of pulled it together in the third period and found a way to win in overtime, which has been one of the things they haven't done that well this year.
So the division, you know, especially these top four in the Metro. So I want to ask you, and I don't have your Super 16 right in front of me. Super 16, by the way, on NHL.com. You should follow it. Rank the top four in order, 1 through 4, Tom.
In the Eastern Conference?
In the Metro.
In the Metro. I have Carolina is the number one team in the division right now, in my opinion. I got to think of Pittsburgh Rangers. I don't know. Rangers, Pittsburgh. I don't know.
Yeah.
Capitals, I would put fourth right now. They haven't played as well the last month or so. But, yeah, I still have Carolina number one.
You got to pick. Rangers?
I'll put Pittsburgh second.
I agree.
All right. I agree, too. And we're all going to anger our New York followers who every week tweet or email me how low the Rangers are. I actually had to move them up two spots in an emergency addition to my Super 16 this year because they beat Florida.
I think I might have had the Rangers ahead of Pittsburgh this week in the Super 16 because Pittsburgh had a bit of a tough week. But even when they lost games, they got points in 3 of 4 of them, and they went to overtime. They went through a rough patch. The Rangers are a resilient team. I like their team a lot. I feel like Carolina, to me, is, you know, I don't know if they're getting even enough credit. They've been doing it so well that it's almost kind of like no one's even paying attention to how good they played.
You did have the Rangers ahead, and that's fine because the way we do the Super 16, you have to understand, is we do take in the power of it, but you have to also look. I mean, the Penguins are all 1-3 in their last four games, so they got to drop a little bit. But you mentioned, and Sean and I have talked about this a lot, and I'm curious your opinion about the Rangers because they are good. They have a lot of skill. They're terrific on the power play. They lack a little bit 5-on-5, in my opinion. And I'm not sold that they have enough, I mean, that they're going to have enough depth to win in the playoffs. You know, you look at these other teams that they could be facing, right? Carolina, Washington, Pittsburgh. That's if they stay within that division. And if they don't, I mean, you're talking about Tampa, Florida, right? Toronto.
You don't want to cross over to the other side.
You don't want to cross over to the other side. So what's your take on the Rangers as a whole when you take into the whole big picture of them?
I'm watching to see how they go as the season goes on. Like, Shesterkin has been so good for them. Is he the reason? Is he covering up more there? Can he do it the whole season long? He's never done it, right?
No.
I mean, I'm not saying he can't do it, but he's never had the opportunity to do it even because this is just the way his career has gone with the pandemic and everything like that. Can he hold up over a long season and into playoffs? If he does, if he continues this play, I mean, I think they could beat anybody in that division, you know. But we'll have to see as the season goes. You're a team, I think, we have to remember that they haven't been in the playoffs in a few years. They have a bunch of young guys. They're still learning. So that, I think they're a team that you have to watch and see how they go over a long season.
Yeah, and the long season is key. We've been here for a long time now, and they've been interviewing some alumni here and Curtis Joseph was talking. He was talking about the Olympics in Nagano, and he was like, you know, we had the best team. And the way he put it was you couldn't put a pee past Toshik. Like, he'd stop everything. And you know, that's a short tournament. But we know that goalies can affect huge swings in leading up to the playoffs. And once you get into the playoffs, you know, you think of a Tim Thomas against Vancouver and things like that, and you wonder what Igor can do. But I also wonder if the Rangers are one of those teams that when the game changes, and like Talk said early in here, when it gets to the hard skill, I know the Rangers have some tough players around the net and Kreider and Reeves, but I just don't know if they have that playoff mentality yet.
They might. I can't remember which coach it was that I covered earlier in my career. It might have been Pierre DeBoer. You talk about things. You go to Christmas, and after Christmas, it picks up a notch. And then you go from Christmas to the All-Star break, and it picks up a notch. Then you go from the All-Star break to the trade deadline, and it picks up another notch. And then you get your team, who you have, and then it's to the playoffs. And so every you go up a level and you learn more about your team as the team, as the season goes on. And the Rangers have a young team. They have some experienced guys too, but they have some young guys. And you're going to learn more about them as the season goes along. That's why I'm not saying they can't do it, but I'm still watching and observing with that team.
And I think Chris Drury is going to go big game hunting for the trade deadline.
That's also, yeah. They should, because they're in a position where they could win. Yeah. You know, you get in, you can do damage. And I don't, if they're there, I wouldn't be surprised if they won some rounds in the playoffs. If they went, you know, the East looks, I mean, we're talking about the West earlier. Both conferences look crazy. I don't know if there's a clear-cut favorite in either one. Like it's going to be an interesting playoffs when we get to that point.
You speaking of the West, you saw a team last night in Washington, Wednesday night in Washington, Edmonton, right? 5-3, Evander Kane gets a goal and an assist. What did you think just watching one game live?
Watching one game, they jumped on the Capitals early, and it was 3-0 within 5 minutes. And I thought that the Capitals, like, said, holy, you know, we got to push back here. And I thought the Capitals played really well from that moment on. And if not for a really bad shorthanded goal, I think, you know, I mean, I'll say this. Koskinen played really well in that game, I think. I think the Capitals could have won the game. I guess it's a long way of saying that I think Edmonton still is not quite there, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I thought that game illustrated their season, right? They come out big, fast. Their big guys score. Then they give up three right away to come back. And the last one, I mean, that's a bad goal, right, that Koskinen gives up. Five hole, can't close it. A little bit of a screen. And the only difference is from what the last month has shown us is they actually pulled their bootstraps up and said, oh, no, we're not going to fold up. And that comes with winning. They'd won
that's
a couple
true.
Of games before that. So, you know, to me, if you're talking about big game hunters at the deadline, it's got to be Kenny Holland. He's got to do more.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, we think they need to upgrade their goaltending. I just don't know how they're going to do it. Can they convince Marc-Andre Fleury to come up there? Can they, you know, like Mike McKenna says he doesn't want to go anywhere. So,
right.
You know, can they convince someone else to come up there or whatever, or find the right? I feel like Edmonton has to, you know, Kenny Holland has to do somehow find someone's other goalie and kind of catch lightning in the bottle. That's their hope. I don't know who that guy is, but, you know, I think back a long time ago to Johan Hedberg. He was like a third goalie in the Sharks system, and the Penguins traded for him. All of a sudden, he became the Moose, and they went all the way to the conference final. Like, they need to find something like that, where some guy who's maybe not as better than people think is in and get a chance, and maybe they give him a chance, and he runs with it.
Well, we'll see if it happens, Tom. You waited long enough. You came in. You were like the righty coming in as the closer. We appreciate it. Thanks for coming over.
Thanks for having me on. It's been fun.
Well, Tom was the perfect closer, and I'm a little out of breath because that was a lot, and I it was all real interesting stuff. But of course, Sean, one thing, we're at All Star. We're at All Star Weekend. It's going to be the All Star Game, the skills competition, Friday night, right? I mean, All Star on Saturday, and there's a lot to look forward to here.
Oh my God, it's going to be crazy. It's Vegas. It's Vegas All Star. So whatever All Star usually is, it's going to be on steroids,
yeah.
Right? Like, it's going to be a crazy party. And you just think about, like, some of the things that are going to happen. I can't wait for skills to see the Vegas-specific stuff they're doing. The fountains at Bellagio where they're shooting pucks in the fountain, right? Or the 22 and 21 where they're playing blackjack on the strip. We had trouble getting here because the strip was closed down because they were filming it. You know, these are Vegas touches, right? It's about the show, and Vegas has become so good at that. So, and then, you know, there's 21 first-time All-Stars here. They're embracing this, and the breakaway challenge is coming back.
Mm-hmm.
Trevor Zegras, Hughes, like, the skill level that's going to be in that is going to be amazing. And Manon Raymond is going to be one of the goalies. And Wyatt Russell, the son of Kurt Russell, who played professionally in Europe, is going to be another one of the goalies. It's going to be an incredible show. And we haven't even gotten to the game yet.
No, I know. I love the skills, too. And I've been fortunate to be able to do reporting on the bench at previous All-Star games from skills. It's always interesting to be – obviously, it's a unique perspective. You know, I'm privileged to have it. When I've done it, and you get the chatter on the bench, it's terrific. You hear things that you would never hear. You see things that you would never normally see. But, you know, those Vegas-specific things are going to be fantastic. But I am, to be honest with you, like, I'm very curious on the fastest skater, because you've got Connor McDavid, who I think we all agree, is probably the fastest player in the National League. I think we'd agree that he's the fastest player in the National League. Cale Makar, Dylan Larkin, who's won it before, and, oh, by the way, Chris Kreider, who I don't know if he could turn, right? But he could go straight really fast.
Yeah, and there's two things, right? Connor McDavid is so fast with the puck on his stick, but that isn't what this is. This is right. A pure acceleration. And you know, it was funny. I was watching the women's hockey game this afternoon, the U.S. versus Finland, and they actually showed highlights of the Kendall Coyne fastest skater, and they showed the reaction on the bench, and they showed, you know, Connor McDavid's face just coming to life and being like, oh my God, what just happened? And they talked about what the impact of that was. You know, we're 3-4 years out, and people are still the lap heard around the world. Like, that is the beauty of the skills, is it gives people an opportunity to see the unadulterated skill. There's nobody trying to put them through the boards. There's no pressure, right? Other than the pressure they're putting on themselves.
There's pressure.
But it's internalized. There's no, the cup isn't on the, like,
right.
You're free to do whatever you think you can do or you want to do, and you're encouraged to go down in flames. Like, you, literally, in some of these creative things, like, there's honor in failing as long as you go big enough.
Yeah. You don't want to fall on the fastest skater, though.
No. But you want to do the Rodney Dangerfield dive, right?
Like, right. Yeah.
That's what you want to do, because the reward is so high and the risk is so low.
Yeah.
Like, if you fail, you fail. Who cares?
You know, and then let's get to the, you know, you get to All-Star Saturday, which is, you know, also going to be, I am a huge fan of, I'm a huge fan of 3-on-3, right, in overtime. And I'm a big fan of how they've changed the All-Star setup. So to make it a 3-on-3, I find it far more interesting. I find it, you know, that third period, which never really, you know, it's like, oh, here we go, another one period. Now it's a, now it, you know, it matters. And you see in previous All-Star games, look, it's not the end-all be-all, but you see the competition ratchet up a little bit. Why does that happen? Well, it's because these guys are the most competitive guys that you'll meet, right? And if a win is on the line, they're going to go for it. They're not going to go for it like they do in the regular season or in the playoffs. No, that'd be crazy. But you can see it ratcheted up. So I do like what they've done in the past several All-Star games, and they're doing it again this one, the 3-on-3 setup, to have three different periods, the winners play in the third period for a championship.
Yeah, no, and the other thing is, you know, people complain that the 3-on-3, the excitement of the 3-on-3 has been coached out. Right, in the regular season, because coaches ruin everything, right?
Like, yeah,
they and I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, they're so focused on those margins of making, taking those little margins and making them work for their team, that some of that chaos of 3-on-3 has gone away because they've coached it just like they coached the regular game, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not in the All-Star.
No.
Right? Because it's all skill, and it's just forward. There's nobody – they come back to generate that forward skill, but there's nobody ragging the puck. There's nobody trying to take time away and say, let's take the point and go home, and we'll decide the shootout later. Like, it's going to be go, go, go.
It's go, go, go. It's fun. Enjoy it, right? As a hockey fan, you just got to enjoy it. You enjoy the purity of the skill, the purity of that, and – have fun with it. It's supposed to be fun, right? It's supposed to be fun. And then we get back to it, and there are some teams that don't play for like 2 weeks, and we'll be on a podcast next week talking about that and everything. But this is about fun, and this was a lot of fun to do the podcast here. Like I said at the top, we got to go remote more.
Yeah, no, this has been the greatest of all our podcasts, and it was a high bar, but we killed it. Multiple guests. You know, we barely had to do any work. We barely had to talk, which is always a good thing. That's good for our listeners. So maybe Bob Bender's got to get us 4 guests every week now.
I think it's on him. That's it. So I hope you enjoyed it. Enjoy All-Star Weekend.
Hope the tables are kind to you, Dan.
We're going to work on that.